Hello, hello. Welcome back to Down and 30. You're tuning in to the second episode of our October special, where we're going to cover a different serial killer case. This week, I have a very special guest with me. You will recognize her. I have my friend Kim back with me. We're going to cover a case that many of you might know, but Kim actually has not heard of yet. So I'm going to tell the story, and we're going to get Kim's reaction. So stay tuned, buckle up, dive in, grab a wine, grab a coffee, grab a shot, whatever works for you. And Kim and I are going to dive right in. Okay, we are live. We've got Kimberly Washington back in the house. Actually, not in the house. She's in her house. We're on Zoom this time. We've got Kim on Zoom, live on Zoom. So this is the first episode that we have ever recorded remotely from each other. Typically, we sit in the backyard, sip a little wine, talk a little shit, but this time we're in our respective homes, sipping a little wine, talking a little shit. Kim, what's going on? How you feeling?
I'm good now. I'm a wine glass in front of me, so now I'm chilling.
We love that. So we've got the wine, and I am in my, you can't see me, but I am in my wine pajama set from Kim's Boutique, Kiwi. So check that out. Link is in the bio as always. It's linked everywhere. We love Kiwi. So check it out. The pajamas are amazing. Yes. Super soft. So for today's episode, we're going to do a little bit of a reaction. I am like the CEO of True Crime. The CEO of every documentary and podcast that is ever out there in the world on any type of crime, mystery, all that good stuff. So you might have heard of this one, but you may not know all the ins and outs. So we brought Kim along for the ride, and Kim is going to give her fresh ears a listen and pop in with the little two cents, and we're just gonna get a fresh perspective on things.
Yes, do a reaction video.
We love that.
Or recording.
Or both. Yeah. All right, so like I said, for a lot of you this is gonna be super familiar. It's actually kind of current because a lot of this has sort of come to light in the recent years. It's actually 2018 that this case sort of finally had a break in it, but it started back in the freaking 70s, so this is going into the archives here. All right, let's introduce it. Let's tell you what we're actually talking about here tonight. All right, Kim, so tonight we've got on deck the Golden State Killer.
I don't think I know this one.
Oh, I love that. I was a little like, I kind of thought maybe when I said the name, you'd be like, it kind of rings a bell a little.
No, call me Living Under a Rock. Call me Patrick Starr.
No, we love that. I love fresh ears. I'm like, I'm so annoyed. Like, I'll talk to anyone who will listen. Hey, have you heard about Golden State Killer? Like, this is. So okay, you might know him as the Golden State Killer. You also might know him as the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, the East Area Rapist, and there was a recent podcast, like 2017, 2018, something like that. A lot of my research and knowledge came from that podcast, actually. It's called The Man in the Window, which if that doesn't just set you up for exactly what's going to be going down, I don't know what the hell. Like, that's the description. So if that doesn't make you, like, sort of sick, sort of get a little chill in the bones type of situation, me with my windows wide open next to me, it's all good. Mm-hmm. So all the nicknames, and the reason for the many nicknames is because there was a series of crimes that went down in California from like the 1970s into the 1980s, and then like when everything sort of came to light, they found out that things were also still happening. Not necessarily like the crimes themselves, but like taunting and terrorizing victims went on until the 2000s. And I'm not going to give too much away. I'm going to sort of tell the story, like, from beginning to end without revealing the identity of this person until the end, because a lot of people might not know. And the shock value, when I tell you the shock value, is on 100 on this one.
We're ready.
We're ready as hell. All right, so like I said, we got the Golden State Killer. He is responsible for at least 100 burglaries, 50 rapes, and at least 30 murders throughout the state of California in the 70s and 80s. Basically, when all this sort of came together and all the crimes were connected, law enforcement realized that they were looking into what was probably one of the most prolific serial killers and serial rapists in our history. The crimes, like the way that he spiraled and it just sort of progressed in, you know, the violence and severity of the crimes is just crazy. Like, one of the podcasts and some of the research that I did, like, even as a kid or like a young adult, like, nasty stuff, like, I'm not even gonna get into it, but just think about, like, animal cruelty, things like that, you know, the vibes with the usual serial killer stuff. So I can't even get into that or I'll spiral into hell. But yeah, so all that was happening even in the early life. And basically how this all sort of like happened was, initially there was just this series of sort of
and like there was nothing of value was being taken from these houses. There was just like a few like little trinkets here and there that would go missing, but people would realize their houses were being broken into. And like occasionally, you know, more valuable things would be taken, or, you know, like I said, pets or animals would be disturbed, so to speak. But it kept progressing from there. Like, next thing you know, it's like, okay, yeah, the break-in, but then people are coming home and they're finding like women's underwear scattered everywhere. Like, the oddness factor.
Oh my God, that's creepy.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, imagine like coming home and like literally your underwear is just confetti.
So creepy.
Kept getting weirder and weirder. So, you know, that went on for like, I think it was like a little less than a year. And then lo and behold, like a year later in the next town over, the crimes start to get a little bit more significant. And instead of just like breaking in and taking little trinkets, this person started to like stalk his victims. So there's this one count, and this is one of the first attempted or one of the first rape victims. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but picture this. It's like this young girl, and literally there is a tap at the window. Can you envision that? I would, if you opened up your blinds and you saw,
I would die.
D-I-E. On site, I would D-I-E.
No.
So picture that. So like right when all of the actual sexual harassment and rape, I should say sexual assault, that's what I meant, and the rape started to happen, one of the cases is so crazy. So this girl, I think she was a teenager for sure, and she lived with her parents and her siblings. And what was at that time known as the East Area Rapist broke into their house and attempted to sexually assault this girl. And I think when the initial encounter happened with the tapping on the window, I think that she was with her boyfriend, and like the rumors had already been out, like this guy was a known thing and people were already scared. And, you know, so she sort of had that suspicion, like, oh my gosh, like, could this guy come for me? But it's one of those things where it's totally not gonna be me. But one night, the tap on her window, and yep, exactly. So the dad and the boyfriend, I think, end up chasing this guy away. And ever since that night, the girl's just like waiting for him to come back. She just had a feeling he would come back.
Oh my God.
Lo and behold, one night she wakes up and he's literally standing in her bedroom. There's a man in her bedroom.
No.
So he takes her out of her bedroom and he tells her, if you make any noise, I'll kill you. I'll kill your family. So apparently, as she's being dragged down the hallway by this guy who's like, I think somehow threatening her. I forget if it's with a gun or a knife or something. Okay. But she made like a whimper or something and it woke up her brother. In turn, somehow dad gets woken up, and at this point he's literally dragging this girl, this victim, on the front lawn, and the girl sees her dad running outside and he turns on the light and she said like the look on his face was like just pure fury, and she said like the dad just let out this scream before chasing down the guy that was dragging his daughter away from their home. And at this point, this is one of the most devastating cases to me.
That's so terrifying.
It's horrific. So by this time, the whole family's awake. Dad's chasing after. And the rapist pulls out a gun and shoots the dad dead on the front lawn. Leaves the girl, but shoots the dad dead.
Wow. So,
second visit, unsuccessful, did not commit sexual assault on that young girl, but killed the dad. And I think that that was actually his first murder victim.
Okay.
Which is devastating.
So he had never killed somebody. He had never killed somebody before that.
Allegedly. And I wonder exactly about the timeline, because like I said, like some of the crimes weren't linked until very recent years. But I think that that is considered one of his first or most early murders, but he certainly did not stop there. So as if that wasn't bad enough, you know, of course these murders get out, and it's, you know, it's California in the 70s, and rape just wasn't considered what it is today. Like, there wasn't even like a statute of limitations on rape. It wasn't as criminalized as it is today. Like, the advice that women were getting were, you know, if this guy comes to you, don't put up a fight, just do what he says. And women in California, some of the victims, like, got together in this, like, coalition against sexual assault and, you know, trying to get this rapist. And they were like, F this. We are not, like, if he comes into my house, no, I'm fighting back. I'm shooting, and I'm shooting to kill, like, whatever the case was.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, like, it was very of the time. So if you think about it, like, murder was one thing back then. But the emphasis on, you know, how criminal of an act rape was back then, there just wasn't that much attention into it. I mean, honestly, I think at that time, like, the burglaries were getting more, you know, interest from law enforcement than the rapes were, which is terrifying when you think about it.
Oh, this is America.
There it is. that's it. So somehow, even after doing all this for years, you know, he's continued to evade law enforcement. So, you know, he gets a little bold. Instead of just going after women who he thinks are home alone or sleeping or something, he eventually evolves into breaking into homes where there's families, there's husbands, there's children, like the whole bit. Like, he finally just goes into just it, anything goes. And they find out what he is actually doing is not just at random, but he is pursuing and stalking his victims, like watching their house all day, every day, figuring out their schedules, knowing when they'd be at work and when they wouldn't, calling the house to see when someone would pick up and when they wouldn't, like the whole thing, figuring out everyone's schedules. And I think initially that sort of started as a way to sort of vet to see when he could get in with, you know, the least suspicion, like, okay, this house doesn't have a dog, go time, I'm ready. But eventually, I think it was sort of like, it upped the ante for him, and like, he liked the idea of more people being home, because it was more people to torture. And the details of some of these crimes, when he started to spiral into pursuing entire families, are sickening. All right, gets a little graphic here. So there are some recounts of his cases, and there's one that was a wife, I think a husband, and a young son. So he breaks in the middle of the night,
I think it was actually the son that woke up first, young son. And eventually,
no.
It was so sad. Eventually the intruder ties them all up, like blindfolds, the whole shebang. And the husband is taken into another room and the wife and the son stay in the bedroom. And the son is in the room, the husband in the other, when he sexually assaults the wife and mother.
Wow.
In the room. I think the son was like 10 years old at the time. In the room.
Wow.
So, as if that's not bad enough, then he starts involving the other family members. So, in other cases, later cases, people would detail that he would, again, tie up, blindfold the family, and he would basically tell the husbands what he was going to do to their wives, and he would threaten them, and he would put, this is so sick, he would literally put the husbands in positions like on all fours or laying down or something, and he would place like china or other objects on their backs while he would take the wife into another room to sexually assault her. And he would tell the husbands, if this plate falls or if this glass crashes, I will kill your wife and then I'll come kill you. So imagine just being in crippling fear.
Wow.
You have a freaking china tea set on your back and your wife is literally being assaulted in the other
room.
I'm
sorry, this should not be funny, but
no, but it should, like,
wow.
It's like, this is how sick the mind was.
That is so crazy.
Mm-hmm. So messed up, so disgusting. So that was happening. And the other thing that was so sick is it wouldn't just be go in, commit the crime, leave. He would stay for hours. The family would be tied up. The wife would be repeatedly sexually assaulted. And this guy would go into the kitchen, literally make himself a meal, cook, do the whole shebang. And meanwhile, he would have these families tied up, bound, and gagged, and, you know, just periodically check in. One story was like, yeah, he went in and grabbed some beer and crackers and then came back in and sexually assaulted me again. Beer and crackers, you took a, okay. Like, this just shows you, like, how sick and, like, where this person's mind was, that literally you're stopping for a little beer and cracker break. But you didn't leave. You couldn't just go to your own house. Nope, you had to keep on doing it. So again, that gives you a little indication of what's going on in the mind. So again, this is like all throughout the 70s. And then we get into the 80s. And again, keep in mind, all through these years, he has completely evaded law enforcement. And initially, no one was connecting the crimes because it was like the burglary started in one town. And then when the crimes escalated, they were happening in another town. So they weren't looking at the same criminal profile, so they didn't link them together. And it really wasn't until much, much later that they started to realize the similarities between some of the cases. But again, made it through the 70s. All the way through the 80s, and it was actually the mid to late 80s where one of his last crimes was, and this is when he was just in like full-blown murder mode. One of his last known crimes was 1986, and this is so horrific. Young girl, 18 years old, Janelle Cruz was her name. At the time of that crime, he kidnapped, bound, raped, and bludgeoned her to death.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine?
Terrifying. 18 years old. Like, that's a baby. Again, despite how horrific these crimes were, the case went cold. All of the cases went cold for decades. So it sort of seemed like at least the known crimes he was committing stopped in 1986 with the case I just mentioned. But there are stories that until at least 2001, he continued to stalk and taunt his prior victims and he would make these disgusting phone calls. The phone calls are so sick. Like, people would say they would answer their phone, and it was just him in this, like, gross whispering voice just saying things like, I'm gonna kill you, or, you know, I'm gonna come back to the job, or, like, for years and years. So you're talking about crimes that could have happened in the 70s, 80s, and he's still calling, taunting them in 2001. Like, imagine that type of trauma. Like, you already go through this trauma, you can't put it behind you, and then this sick fuck is calling you and taunting you and reminding you frequently of all of that. All right, so how are we feeling about the case so far?
So honestly, I feel like this is something straight out of Criminal Minds. Because, you know, I've been on it. I've been on a Criminal Minds, like, kick, and even, like, some of the episodes that I've been watching haven't even been this crazy. I think the part that gets me is, like, the fact that the one that got me was when she saw him tap on the window, and then he came back.
He came, like, back.
That's, like, my fear.
Like, can you imagine, like, that would be the scariest night ever, and then to, you know, your worst fear is, like, oh my gosh, this predator is going to come back, and then he does, and your dad ends up dead, like,
And the types of, like, choices he makes his victims to make, like, is also, like, mentally, like, torture. Like, for the girl, when he was dragging her, he's like, if you make a sound, I'll kill you and your whole family. So it's like, you want to survive, but you also don't want to kill your family. So, like, you have to make a choice. Like, do I make a sound or do I go? Right. Knowing that if you go, you're probably going to die. And then the same thing with the men. Like, you know, it's like, if I hear the China move, I'm killing your wife. And it's kind of like, how to protect your wife, but at the same time, if you move, then she's for sure dead. It's just like,
the mental. Mind. And speaking of,
it's the mind games for me.
The couples basically said in some cases, like, he would contradict himself. Like, he would say to the wife, if I see anything about this on the news or the paper tomorrow, I'll come back and kill you. And then he'd go in the next room to the husband tied up, and he'd say, if I don't hear about this on the news or paper tomorrow, I'll come back and kill you. It was just total mind game. So you could start to see, and law enforcement was sort of guessing back and forth, like, clearly this person has a little intel, they have a little skill, a little knowledge of how to get away with these types of things and how to pursue these things. So they thought possibly, like, a couple of different things. They thought maybe, like, a meter authority person, they thought law enforcement. What were some of the other, I don't know, a bunch of things they thought, and every lead that they thought they had just kept coming up cold. And again, keep in mind, these are all different counties, so you have different jurisdictions working on different cases and not necessarily knowing what's connected and what isn't. So again, we bring ourselves back to, we've made it through, and now we're in the early 2000s, and he's still taunting, still calling, still doing the whole thing. So, you know, we've seen him progress from, you know, petty burglary crimes to sexual assault and rape, and just full blown, I'm out to kill. So one of the things that I think is such a shock value in this case, besides the actual crimes themselves, is how and when all of this eventually came to light. So I'm trying to think of what's the best way to lay this on you. Okay.
So I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question interrupting here.
And we love this.
So he got away with this because no one would talk. Is that what's going on? Like, were people talking or were they
too afraid? They were talking.
So it's just a matter of, like, limitations due to technology and things.
So I think it was a combination of, you have the conflicting threats from him. You have the fact that these crimes are spiraling in different cities, different parts of the state, and in each part of the, you know, the timeline of his crimes happened in a different manner and a different location. So it's not like they're saying, oh, we've got 5 rapes in this town, five rapes in the next town mm-hmm. over and five more that look identical in another town. Like, they were different crimes, different levels of violence in different areas.
Oh, like, so they can't connect it.
Yeah, they weren't like talking to each other from town to town, like, hey, we've got this and so do you. It was like he totally knew how to almost like create a new criminal identity each time he sort of evolved on his spree. And then also, again, like I said, like it, a lot of it was initially rape and burglary, and that was just not criminalized in the way that it is today at all.
Yeah.
And then, there's the component of technology and forensic DNA and advancement and all that good stuff, which is why it took until, are you ready for it? 2018 is when this case finally had a break. So it was sort of, it wasn't exactly collaborative efforts, but it was a combination of a private investigator, and then also, I forget who hired the private investigator, but it was a private investigator, and then also the Sacramento District Attorney's Office, I believe, that we're sort of pursuing this idea of, okay, so right now all the rage are these DNA profiles that people are doing online to check their heritage, their lineage, the whole bit.
And so law enforcement thought that this idea of these DNA websites where people are literally uploading their DNA onto websites to, you know, uncover and meet people that they might be related to, they thought, okay, let's run these samples, whatever limited samples we have of this guy from these cold cases from the 70s and 80s, and let's see if we get any hits. So they had sort of like, you know, leads that just went cold over and over again. And actually one time when they each thought they were getting really close, the DA and the private investigator, you know, they found this match that was like essentially what ended up being, when you break it down in terms of DNA, like 900 years ago, this DNA match would have put their criminal as like a relative of this person that they found the DNA for. So like, that's how distant it was, but it was like the closest hit they'd had since the 70s. When they actually looked into it, basically what they found out was it was actually each of them. It was the private investigator and the DA that had been each trying to find this criminal, but instead they ended up finding each other. So it was another like dead end. And then they were like, hey, we're working on the same case. Let's link up. So at that time, they really did end up collaborating, and eventually they get this hit, and they just can't believe the information that they're finding out from this DNA sample. So somehow through all of this genetic genealogy technique, they are able to identify a gentleman, and they zero in on this specific suspect, and the suspect's name is Joseph D'Angelo. So once authorities set their sights on him, they zero in, they surveil him, and they just completely, they lock in on him. And once they officially run the DNA on him, they're able to run something that they found from a trash can or something. It was April of 2018 that they were able to match his DNA that showed up on one of these genealogy sites to DNA that was found at the crime scenes in the 70s and 80s. Can you imagine that? Like, this dude literally got away with it for decades. And it literally like a piece of trash that he threw out after they sort of, you know, had some idea of who this person might be. A piece of trash, it literally is what ended up sealing the deal. But you're going to love this. They catch this guy. They zero in. And what do they find out?
He is literally retired law enforcement. Yes. So that whole time, he was committing all these crimes, he was working for different counties. Like, I know of at least three different counties or positions of law enforcement that he held during these crimes. So it's just insane that, I mean, like, again, it just explains how, you know, at least one of the reasons why he was able to conduct such, you know, horrific crimes and figure out ways to get away with it.
And because he knew the system.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, in 1970, you're not really thinking about DNA you're leaving behind. And then, you know, the 2000s and certainly 2018 hits and 23andMe and Ancestry.com. And I'm not saying that's what they use, but all of that is all the rage. And they pop that DNA into a system and lo and behold, somebody's 1800th cousin shows up. Like,
wow.
Yeah. So since that time, there's been like, you know, different changes in law and whether or not you're allowed to use that type of DNA sample and blah, blah, blah. It was so new at that time when they used it. They literally got in at the right time and were able to actually utilize the sample and the findings from those websites to arrest him. And he, Joseph DeAngelo, was taken into custody. And he said it to himself on a taped interview when he was in police custody, and he said, "I did all those things. I destroyed all those lives." Oof.
Wow.
So
he was doing.
And he basically, you know, what ended up happening is he pled guilty to at least 13 counts of first degree murder. And keep in mind, at this trial, this hearing, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, victims and victims' family members were all present during this. So in front of all these people and their families, he pled guilty to 13 counts of first-degree murder. And I think they were able to get him on, like, one or two other little things. But he, unfortunately, was never able to be convicted of all of the rapes he committed, again, because the statute of limitations was up and those types of things weren't criminalized at the time he committed them. So those people who went through the sexual assault by him, you know, in some ways they didn't quite get their justice, but he is serving multiple consecutive life sentences.
Alive.
Oh, girl, wait for it. Wait for it. Multiple. In some news reportings, I read up to 11, but probably to me 13 makes more sense if that's what he was charged with. Consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. So, yes, indeed, he is still alive. Actually, it was only as recent as June 2020. That he pled guilty. Like, so they arrest him in 2018, and then the whole, you know, the whole bit has to go on. But it was June 29th of 2020, to be exact, that he committed, that he pled guilty to the crimes he committed in the 70s and 80s. Like,
wow.
That's crazy. And so, yes, he is still alive. He is obviously currently in prison. Where he will serve the rest of his days in prison without the possibility of parole. He is, I think he's in his 80s at this point. No, he's in his 70s. He's 74 at this point. And yeah, I mean, like, when you look at his pictures, so just Google the name Joseph DeAngelo. People, if you haven't done this already, this is the man that is currently... Yeah, this is the guy that's currently sitting in jail. This is his mugshot. For over 100 burglaries, at least 50 rapes, and at least 30 murders. Only 13 of which he has pled guilty to. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
He looks like the guy from Saw.
I mean, he looks literally like your worst nightmare. Like the worst nightmare.
It's like if you watch the Saw series and you think that someone is going to come for you, this is what you picture.
And it's like, you talk about criminal minds. Like, the little nicknames. So Visalia Ransacker, East Area Rapist, East Side Rapist, like all of that, like all of these names, like they were all the same guy this whole time for decades. It's crazy. Oh
my God. I see pictures of him when he was younger. He looks so normal. Mm-hmm. That is so scary.
Mm-hmm. So the other interesting thing is one of the interviews with one of the victims, and this is in other podcasts or, you know, news articles that you could read. But one of the victims said that either during or after the sexual assault he committed on her, he said the name Bonnie, and that was actually how, that was part of how they connected him to these crimes. It was this whole big web of everything. But Bonnie was actually his ex-fiance from the 70s or 80s, who broke off her engagement with him because he was clearly abusive, and she could recognize that, and he was controlling, and, you know, he threatened her, and, you know, all these things, held her one night at her window, held her at gunpoint, and threatened to take her to another state so that they could, you know, elope and be married. And it was just such a big part of him. And, you know, you have these cases sometimes where it's like people are like, oh, he led such a normal life. And in some ways, yeah, he did. But, you know, his ex-fiance, you know, she was on it. You know, I give her props. She recognized that, hey, this dude there's something not right here. And she refused to marry him. And, you know, of course, she never had any idea that he was capable of those things. But just other things in their relationship let her know that this is not the relationship for me. You know, so I think it's sort of one of those things where this person is clearly a sick individual. And, you know, you have someone that's mixed with this illness and their ability and their knowledge to elude law enforcement, and then coupled with this, there's issues with the broken family dynamic when he was younger. He clearly had issues with women even in his younger years, like all of this, and you create this monster. And I don't know, this is one of the cases that I could not believe it when I was hearing it. What did you think?
Yeah. I honestly was so creeped out because it's like something that, it's the mind games, like I said before, mm-hmm. like that he would play on people, and the fact that he was law enforcement and like it's just like your average Joe. You know? I know, I'm sorry, I had to do it.
You had to. Your average Joe D'Angelo.
And to think that he did all these cool things, like, oh. And it's like, you're a nightmare. Like, I don't know, I'm that type of person that I will wake up in the middle of the night, I go to the bathroom, I will double check that all my windows and doors are locked.
For sure.
I make sure all the blinds are closed. Just...
like,
this is why.
How many times
why.
Have you looked out your window and, like, you're sure you're going to see someone there?
I literally will probably not sleep tonight because the one window by my bedroom has this tree branch that like goes
tap, I'm tap, so tap. Sorry I did this to you.
Oh, this is Joe D'Angelo. Oh.
I know.
No, but he's in jail. It's fine.
He's in jail. Before, and so. He's like a million years old, but you know, this one messed me up.
I think that's what messed me up is the fact that it's like, I don't want to say realistic because obviously they're all real, but it's like.
Right.
Something that could happen to you easily.
No, I completely agree.
Oh,
so
gosh.
Scary. But I do want to, before I forget, I want to give a shout out to where I did most of my research. So I had a lot of news articles, recent and then past. And, you know, it's interesting because this case was cold for so long. There's so much information out there. And, you know, some of it is obviously written from the perspective of this person has yet to be apprehended. And then you have the more recent news of, you know, the case being broke and all that stuff. But a lot of my research started after I listened to the podcast titled The Man in the Window. Highly recommend. Great storyteller. Excellent, excellent. It's, you know, a bunch of interviews and all this great information and firsthand accounts. So highly recommend that. And one of the people that is actually attributed to this case actually, you know, kind of coming back into the forefront of investigations, is the late author Michelle McNamara. She wrote a book called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. And after she wrote that book, this case sort of came back to the forefront and got people more interested again. And lo and behold, after that, it's when it broke and all this information came out and they actually found him. So props to her. So sad that she did not live to see him be apprehended. But shout out to her because, you know, she's not just an author. Yes. Like you solved a decades old cold case, honey, and that's an incredible legacy to leave behind.
Wow.
We love incredible. That. We love a woman on a mission.
On a mission with a pen.
For sure. All right. Any final thoughts? Any final anything before we each pour another glass of wine and cry ourselves to sleep? I'm literally gonna go pull my shades down right now. I'm like terrified.
Well, that was fun though. And thank you for having me on. I enjoyed this story in a weird, creepy, I like to be scared out of my mind type of way.
I love that. I appreciate you being the guinea pig for this and, you know, willing to expose yourself to this sort of story. But, you know, it's a real story. And, you know, I think especially for all the people that were not able to really get justice because the crimes committed against them were well beyond the statute of limitations. You know, I think the more people that know that Joe is a piece of shit is great. And I'm just so glad that he is serving all those life sentences. And, you know, I really don't think that he deserves any more notoriety than that. So I prefer to call him the Golden State Killer because personally, I don't think he's worth a name.
So I'm assuming this was all in, where was this? California?
California. Wow. A lot of stuff happens on the West Coast, baby.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff happens, so stay tuned. Stay tuned. I got some other West Coast rock stars showing up later on in the series. Not kidding.
West Side.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on. Love you the mostest.
No problem. This is fun.
Guys, fear not. We'll have Kim back on again. And who knows? Maybe it'll be another scary episode. Maybe she'll come back during our regularly scheduled program. But we appreciate you all for being here. And we will see you and speak with you next time when it is time to get down and 30.
Bye, guys. Happy spooky season.
We love that.